On air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Coming up today, a hefty fine for illegally clearing land in Tasmania for agriculture.
It was almost 7 hectares of wetland, which is the threatened native vegetation community, and almost 13 hectares of what we call Melaleuca forest. I think what the Hobart Magistrates Court has shown is that this offence is of a serious nature.
And a solution to getting much needed feed to King Island farmers.
It's fantastic news. I'm sure there will be people that will be over mean because it's just been so hard to even try and get feed, let alone the logistics of trying to get it to the island.
Finally, some logistics action for King Island farmers in desperate need of fodder for their livestock. That story coming up for you shortly. And if you're thinking of clearing land on your farm, have a listen to our first story today, where a clearing operation on one farm has led to a hefty fine. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you on this Monday Great Ag Fest event, from all reports, especially with the weather. And we'll see if there's any rain on the horizon when we talk to the Bureau at the halfway stage of today's program. Also, we'll hear from one of the Seed Lab producers who attended AgFest this year for the first time and how the program has helped their small business. Lots to cover on this Monday, including your thoughts as well. 0438 922 936, that text line number. 0438 922 936. Love to hear from you, just to say g'day. Well, first up today, a decision to clear a wetlands and a Melaleuca forest on a northwest Tasmanian farm has proved costly for the property owners, a New South Wales-based company. The Hobart Magistrates Court has convicted and fined the owners $120,000 for illegally clearing the land for agricultural use. Ann Tudor from the Tasmanian Forest Practices Authority says the fine is a strong warning for farmers across the state to do the right thing when deciding to clear any land on their farms.
So the company was convicted of two offences, being clearing of trees, and the second offence being the clearance and conversion of a threatened native vegetation community.
And where exactly did this occur?
It occurred in a property at West Montague, west of Smithton.
How many hectares are we talking here? We're talking a very large clearance?
It was almost 7 hectares of wetland, which is the threatened native vegetation community, and almost 13 hectares of what we call Melaleuca forest.
Are you surprised that this occurred?
Look, I'm disappointed it occurs, and particularly when there's impacts on a threatened native vegetation community, which is a particularly sensitive area. There are rules and regulations around what you can do in terms of clearance and conversion or clearing of trees, and there's a system and process to follow. So what disappoints me is that there is a system and it can be used, and when it's not, we see significant environmental impacts like we have here.
Let's talk about that wetland area. What was in there that was destroyed?
Well, a wetland is a what we call a vegetation community, and wetlands, wetlands can form a huge variety of different types of communities and have host different plants and animals in them. But what's important about this is that it's what we call a threatened native vegetation community. And that means that these communities, like wetlands, have been listed under state legislation as being important. And our legislation doesn't allow conversion of these communities. So it doesn't allow loss of the communities in the landscape. And that's because they're quite important. And wetlands are quite important for things like threatened plants and animals. And they also have good water filtering properties. So they're really sensitive and highly valued in our landscape, and we need to protect them.
And the Melaleuca forest, describe that situation for us. Is it not the go to just go in and clear a Melaleuca forest?
It depends on the forest type. So Melaleuca, it's generally considered to be called paperbark forest, and it will depend on where it is in the landscape and exactly what form of the community it takes. So there is some paperbark forest that is also listed as a threatened native vegetation community. In this case, I believe it wasn't a threatened native vegetation community, but you still require a forest practices plan to clear vegetation or clear trees. And paperbark, the Melaleuca, is a tree. This is what we call unauthorised clearing.
And just to spell it out for us, what was the clearing, the final product? What was meant to happen?
I suspect it was clearing for agricultural development, so for pasture.
What do we know about the company that's been convicted?
I don't know a lot about the company that's been convicted. We focus on the impacts and whether it was unlawful or unauthorised. So our focus is on what's happened, what the environmental impact might be.
Was there any evidence that the company tried to get clearance to do what it did?
Not to my knowledge.
And is this a situation that occurs far too often, or is it a rare event?
It's a situation that does occur, and when it occurs in areas like these threatened native vegetation communities that are sensitive, it is of particular concern to the authority. The FPA has a function, and we investigate these instances from time to time as they occur.
Can you tell us how it came about that it came to your attention?
I'm not aware of the exact details of how this one came to our attention, but we do get notified of potentially or alleged illegal land clearing from time to time from different sources. And so there's a range of whether it's people call it and report it in, or it can be picked up by satellite imagery, for example.
And in this age of expansion of agriculture, what's your advice for farmers wanting to maybe clear more land to do more agricultural pursuits?
Yeah, sure. My advice is to check before you start any operations. There is a system and there's processes in place to regulate how land clearance occurs in Tasmania, particularly the clearing of trees or the clearance conversion of threatened native vegetation communities. So the most important thing is if you are planning to do some activities like agricultural development, please check, look at the FPA's website or contact us for information.
And what about people out there who own properties and can see that there's something happening next door or down the road? Should they talk to FPA?
Look, if they witness something or if they're seeing something happening which they're concerned about, they are very welcome to email or phone the Forest Practices Authority.
$120,000, it's a decent old fine, isn't it?
I think what the Hobart Magistrates Court has shown is that this offence is of a serious nature, and that really validates the work that our investigators do looking into these situations.
It's Ian Tudor from the Tasmanian Forest Practices Authority talking about the New South Wales-based company which was fined $120,000 for illegally clearing wetlands and part of a forest on a farm at West Montague in the northwest of the state. And if you do need more information about the clearing of land on your property, the regulations can be found on the FPA website, fpa.tas.gov.au. King Island farmers have welcomed a resolution to the stalemate over much-needed fodder being shipped to the island from Victoria. First shipment of the feed is expected to arrive on King Island midweek, after the state government came to an agreement with the operators of Port Welshpool to ship hay through the Gippsland port. The agreement came after the Colac Otway Shire Council pulled out of talks about handling the feed through the closest port to King Island at Apollo Bay. King Island farmer Beth Velikoop spoke to our reporter Madeline Rojan after hearing the hay will be on its way to the island this week.
It's fantastic news. I'm sure there will be people that will be over the moon because it's just been so hard to even try and get feed, let alone the logistics of trying to get it to the island.
And how much of a relief is this then to hear that there will be feed coming to help and support farmers and they don't have to wait for the grass to grow?
Mixed feelings. Like, I'm absolutely elated that there's going to get some feed here. Whether it'll be enough, I don't know whether it'll be enough to help people get through. Like I said, sourcing feed's been terrible. And people, like, we've destocked and it's going to take us quite a few years to build up our stock numbers again. A lot of other people have destocked. You know, they've just been desperate enough to sell their breeding stock or the cattle that they would have grown for next year to sell. So there's going to be a flow-on effect that's going to last a few years. It's not just going to be magically fixed. Mm. You know, even if every bit of feed in the world dropped on King Island right now, it's not going to fix the problem that we're going to have while everybody has to try and recover.
Yeah, so there's some damage, a lot of damage that's already been done.
Yes. You know, in our history, in our family history of farming, we've never destocked like we have this year. We've just, and you know, that's a choice we made because we just needed to get the cattle off the farm. So there's a lot of other people that have done the same, and it was a wise decision. It's a good decision that we've made, but it's going to take, it might take 3 years to recover from it. It might take longer, I don't know.
And how much did you have to destock, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm not going to give you the exact number. We've sold most of next year's cattle that we would have, you know, raised onto quite large animals. They're gone. So our next year's income is already gone. We're very fortunate, farmers are fortunate in that there's the ability to have farm bonds. So while this year we're madly selling cattle and we're going to have a fantastic income, even though we've sold our cattle early, we're going to have to lock that money into farm bonds to then give us a spread of income so that we've got something for next year.
What has it been like waiting for an agreement to be reached?
For us personally, we've been feeding almond husks. So we've been still going along okay. I know for a lot of people, they've been absolutely desperate. They haven't even got the almond husks, and they've been, you know, just hanging out for this agreement to happen and to be able to get some fodder in.
Do you think that it could have moved a lot faster?
Possibly, but, I mean, there's a lot of red tape that's got to go into it, and we can appreciate that. We don't expect everything to happen overnight, but it's great news that it is going to come in, so that's really good news. I would like to thank everybody who's been involved in the need for feed and anybody who's been involved in trying to get the feed over to King Island. Thanks.
You just said it's a Band-Aid solution. What would you like the government to do to make this a long-lasting solution?
I think what would have been handy was if there'd have been information right from the start about where you could source feed from, if there'd have been somebody who could have perhaps had a list of where you can source things. Most people have just been doing word of mouth through people that know someone who knows someone, and that's been quite a strange thing because we don't normally have to do it. The knowledge base hasn't been there.
King Island farmer Beth Velikoop talking there to Madeleine Rajan about the news that much-needed feed is finally on its way to the island this week after a resolution over a shipping agreement in Victoria. Some good news for the King Island farmers. On our text line, welcome back, Tony. Thank you, Anne. Thank you. Len from Benny at least says the farmer who cleared that land should be made to restore the land back to what it was. Thanks for your message there, Len. 0438 922 936. Apparently the damage was so bad that the wetlands were just totally destroyed. Well, talking about pests, we shall talk about fire ants in just a moment.
Take your afternoon adventure with Joel Reinberger.
Go to areas that are uncharted.
On Afternoons with Joel, it's Access All Areas.
Welcome to the best view of Hobart. This is the Bridge of Investigator.
From the forest.
Why does a Silicon Valley kid move to Tasmania?
Getting here for the giant forests.
And the mountains.
This beautiful view of Koonunny Wellington.
To the sea.
On a clear day, the horizon is about 13 kilometres away.
Listen and learn with Joel Reinberger.
Absolutely.
Weekdays from 1:30.
It's a great place to hang out.
On ABC Radio Hobart.
On air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
DNA testing has confirmed fire ants detected at a southern Queensland defence base are connected to an existing Brisbane infestation. Queensland Premier Stephen Miles has told Parliament it was highly likely the ants came from a turf farm, but they've been contained within the Swartz Barracks at Oakey, around 30 k's west of Toowoomba. In a statement, a defence spokesman said the department is working with the eradication program to mitigate the spread. The Invasive Species Council advocacy manager, Rhys Pienta, says an audit of all nearby bases is needed.
The Oakey fire infestation has now been initially surveyed, and they've checked around 130 hectares in and around the immediate vicinity of the nests that were detected at Schwartz Barracks. No further nest clusters have been found, but there's going to be some ongoing work, and it will take years to make sure that that the fire ants that are there haven't spread any further.
130 hectares is a big area, but can you give us an idea of how the nests that have been found are located on the barracks? Are they quite close together or spread apart?
Yeah, so one of the surprising things about the nests that have been detected is they're in two very tight clusters at Schwartz Barracks. So there's something like 78 to around 120 nests, all tightly packed into a very small area on the property. So that's surprising because fire ant nests usually do spread out, particularly these type of single queen colonies that have been at the site. But it's also very encouraging because the fact that they've now checked 70 hectares around and not found any further nests, it's probably a sign that they might not have spread, but it will take years of surveillance to make sure that the area is clear.
Well, you mentioned they're a single queen nest. What makes that different?
Yeah, so single queen nests, they spread mainly through queens flying to new locations to establish fire ant nests. The other kind of colony that you get from fire ants is the multi-queen or polygyne infestations. And they spread by, the queen will walk to a new location and establish a nest. So these are the monogyne kind, the single queen colonies. So there is a risk that they could have flown quite some distance to establish a nest in a new location in and around the Oakey area.
And is there any idea how long at this point that infestation may have existed prior to being detected?
It could have been there for years. Reproductive queens were found in the colonies, which shows that these nests have been established at the site for some time, which is quite concerning. But it is encouraging that a member of the community was able to identify these and report them. And we're encouraging people in and around the Oakey area to keep their eye out. And if they see suspicious ants, to report them to the National Fire Ant Eradication Program.
How far can those single queens fly?
The furthest that a queen has ever been recorded flying is 32 kilometres.
Wow.
And that was in very favourable winds, and it was a lightweight queen. The average distance is actually a couple of hundred metres. But people in and around the area should keep their eye out, you know, up to a few kilometres away.
How long does it take to get an infestation like this under control? I know you've said that it could be years before we can say for certain this site is clear, but what work is happening now?
The immediate response from the eradication teams when they go in is to identify the fire ant nests and eradicate them instantly using a liquid insecticide that they inject into the colony. Then they'll go through a process of baiting, where the ants will forage the bait, take it back, and it will actually essentially starve the queen, make the fire ant nest die out. But one of the unique things about fire ants is they have a great ability to survive for a long period of time deep underground, particularly in drier weather. They can seek shelter below ground. So the reason it takes years to check that a fire ant infestation is eradicated is you've got to get every single nest, because if you miss one, they'll quickly repopulate the area. And because they can hide underground, you need to do that over several seasons to make sure you've got them all.
Have you had any indication from the program or from Defence about whether there are checks happening at bases that may have received vehicles or aircraft from Oakey prior to the detection happening?
We haven't had any feedback on that yet. We've written to the Federal Defence Minister and the Agriculture Minister and asks that a comprehensive audit be undertaken for military defence land in and around southeast Queensland, northern New South Wales, and any properties that may have engaged contractors from this site or had shipments of freight and cargo from this site. We think that defence land has been identified as a problem for fire and eradication efforts in an independent review in 2021. So we think that it should be prioritised that some checking and an audit take place to make sure that there's no other fire infestations hidden away on defence land in other parts of Australia. It's really encouraging that the response from the fire and eradication program to this detection of importance was so quick. They had a team out there within 24 hours of the fire ants being identified and reported. But it's the nests out there that we haven't found that are the problem, that could be out there, you know, growing and multiplying in someone's paddock or in a creek or unattended land. they're the ones we need to find so that the fire eradication teams can get on top of them.
That's Invasive Species Council Advocacy Manager Rhys Pianta speaking to Carly Buchanan about the fire ants nests found in the Oakey area near Toowoomba in Queensland. Now, coming up shortly for you, we will take you to Seed Lab at AgFest and the story of one of the Seed Lab cohorts is doing very well and attending his first AgFest. That story shortly.
Coast to Coast, this is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
And good day to Roger on the text line 0438922936. Good to hear from you too, Roger. 0438922936. A group representing milk processors is warning Australian farmers that they're being paid much more than the world price for dairy. The Australian Dairy Products Federation has released data it says shows farmers in Australia are being paid a premium of as much as 30%. As the clock ticks on a new season's milk prices, which are announced by June the 1st, the CEO of the ADPF, Janine Waller, is warning farmers that price cuts could be coming.
And I think the biggest point is that there's clearly a disconnect between the global commodity prices, so the prices of your powders, your cheese, your butter, and the farm gate milk price that we're seeing here. And that's really what we're trying to help the farmer understand, is what's actually going on and what will that then mean in terms of 1 June and the prices that they may see.
So your argument is that milk is overpriced in Australia right now?
It's more just trying to highlight the facts as to what goes into the milk price in Australia. And at the moment, we're not competitive with what's going on internationally.
So paint that picture. Talk numbers. What are we looking at here? How much more is the industry paying for milk in Australia compared to competitors around the world?
Yeah, absolutely. The biggest indicator that we use is a term called the commodity milk value, and I don't want to complicate by terms. So simply it's a forward price indicator. It's a mechanism that we can use that gives us a bit of an indication around milk price. And at the moment, that's sitting at about $7.30 per kilogram of milk solids. Maybe the number not as important as the difference to what we're currently paying for milk at the moment. So it's a 30% less than, or $2 less than what we're paying for our average price of milk in our southern region, which is sitting at about $9.40 per kilo of milk solids. So it's that big difference. You've got a 30%, $2 less differential between that value and the price that we're paying at the moment. In addition to that, though, we look at spot prices. So we look at the prices of what's going on with cheese, milk powders, etc. And that's really thinking about where does milk end up. The most significant drop we've seen has been with cheese. So that's down almost 30%. So again, that's important because the bulk, you could almost say almost sort of 40, 50% of our milk is going into cheese. And when the price of that is dropping at a global level, it obviously means then that there's a consequence because our cost of production is still going up.
So you're saying that dairy farmers should expect a 30% fall in price when it comes to June?
No. Our role as ADPF is really to talk about the landscape. What happens in terms of numbers is really between processors and farmers.
Is it any real surprise that a group representing largely processors would say milk's overpriced?
So we're not saying it's overpriced. You've got to be careful, obviously, with the language that we're using. As you said, compared to what's happening internationally, there's clearly a disconnect. So there's obviously a high cost. But as you said, it's recognising milk is such an important ingredient. So we want to be fair to the farmer, and it's about being fair to the processor because we want everybody to be here for the long term. And really what it's trying to put it into perspective is we are seeing from a processing perspective businesses close. You know, that's the reality that's happened because of the tough market conditions, but that's also a sign of them rationalising so that they can make sure that supply meets their business model and that they're here for the long term as well.
When you talk about the state of play the dairy industry has found itself in is a supply and demand situation, hasn't it? Because of either actions of previous processes, some of which don't exist anymore, the milk pool in Australia shrunk significantly, and to keep factories going, processors had to overpay. So do you worry for the industry, if you're looking at the wider landscape, if the price drops next season, more farmers will simply exit the industry and you'll remain in this difficult spiral that the industry can't get itself out of?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely valid. I mean, as you said, supply demand is part of it, but there's so many other elements that are at play. I think it's about how do we make sure that we are the right size so that we've got the supply that we need, that we can pay a fair price for that, and that we can compete locally and internationally. And it's really about getting that balance right. And ideally, you know, getting the farmer having his product value and the process of obviously being sustainable at the same time.
So how do you do that? Because it's a balancing act, isn't it, for the industry? You can't afford too many more farmers to leave, but you can't afford processors continually losing money.
100%. As you said, it's sort of the business 101. And there's so many factors as to why production has dropped. You know, when you look at it from a farmer perspective, they've had challenges with input costs and labour and competing land uses, whether it's, you know, beef versus dairy. So there's so many factors that are at play that we've got to work through collectively to go, how do we get the right volume of milk that we need at the right time of year for the right price, so that, as you said, you've got the farmer that is here for the long term and you've got the processor that's here for the long term, and we can compete with all of the products on a local perspective and also internationally.
The mathematics of setting the price of milk, it's a tough one. CEO of the Australian Dairy Products Federation, Janine Waller, speaking there to Warwick Long about the price of milk currently being paid to dairy farmers compared to what the price of milk is on the international market. It's about $2 less. A subject close to dairy farmers, of course, and consumers, and one we'll know more about next month when the dairy prices will be released. Will there be any reductions? We'll wait and see. Still to come on the Country Hour, how Seedlab Tasmania is helping producers. We'll speak to one of those producers who attended AgFest for the first time this year, and also how to protect beneficial insects on farm. Plus, we'll check the latest on the weather. First up, the news headlines with Ellie Ward.
Thanks, Tony. Mexican authorities have confirmed that three bodies found in a well in a remote part of Baja, California, are that of Perth brothers Jake and Callum Robinson and their American friend, Jack Carter Road. They believe the Robinsons and their friend were shot dead by thieves who were trying to steal their car for its tyres. Jackie Lambie Network members have responded to criticism regarding their confidence and supply agreement with the Liberal government. Political commentators criticised the deal between the Jackie Lambie Network and the government, saying the new MPs had signed away some of their ability to be independent while receiving little in return. A Tasmania Police patrol boat has left the state after 30 years of service. Police vessel Van Diemen was sold to the Australian Federal Police, which has gifted it to the Papua New Guinea government. A new patrol boat will replace PV Van Diemen for Tasmania Police with enhanced speed and stability to assist in search and rescue and detect illegal fishing. More news at 1.
Time now to check the latest on the weather. Matthew Thomas joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Matthew.
Hi, Tony.
How are you going? All right?
Yeah, pretty good, thanks.
Excellent, excellent. Now, the rainfall, where has it gone? What's happening?
Oh, yeah, we've been very much in a rainfall deficit. Certainly for the last 3 months over much of Tasmania. But actually, when you go back and look at the rainfall for the last sort of 12 to 16 months, it's also been fairly low. And unfortunately, it's going to be that way into the next few weeks as well. But there could be a little bit about the East Coast in coming days. So, look, the rainfall, 2:09 a.m, we saw some light showers along the south coast with only 1 millimetre at Tasman Island being the sort of, anything more than just a sort of a 0.2. So there wasn't terribly much in that, and since 9 a.m. we've seen no significant rainfall over the state. But As I said, there is some potentially coming for the east coast. Now, what we've got is a high-pressure system to the south of the Eyre Peninsula, extending a ridge across Tasmania today. Mostly fine day today. Not really expecting to see much in the rain gauge anywhere across the state. Into tomorrow, we will start to see some light showers develop about the northwest of the state, the southwest and along the south coast, but rainfall amounts of 0 to 2 millimetres. That high pressure centre will start to move to the south of Tasmania as Tuesday progresses. We'll see some morning frost and areas of fog inland tomorrow morning, and there is going to be a frost warning that is going to be issued for parts of the state, including the central north, the Midlands, possibly the East Coast District in the Upper Derwent Valley as well. And that will be with temperatures getting down to below 0 degrees, but between 0 degrees and minus 2 degrees. Into Wednesday, we will see that high-pressure system move over the Tasman Sea and develop a trough along the east coast. We will see some showers develop about the east and the southeast as a result of that, with light showers also pushing across the Bass Strait Islands. And it should be fine elsewhere, apart from possible morning fog inland. Now, with those showers, and very similar pattern to persist through Wednesday, Thursday and Friday, and with those showers about the east coast, we're looking at some locations potentially getting 10 to 30 millimetres across those 3 days. Into the southeast, the totals will be just a little bit more modest, probably more 2 to 10 millimetres. But there's going to be some precipitation coming for the east coast.
All right. Any idea which areas of the east coast may get up to that 30 mil over the 3 days? We're looking at north of east coast or southeast coast.
So what we're looking at is it does vary from model to model, but I think the along the southeast and the lower east more on Wednesday, but then more of the central east and upper east coast into Thursday and Friday seems to be the indication, but I would suspect that it's going to be the central and upper east coast, mainly about the elevated ground.
Okay, Matthew, you mentioned that frost warning. Any other warnings at the moment?
No, we have no other warnings.
And the coastal waters and swell, probably a good day to go out in the water.
Yes, the winds aren't terribly strong, so we've got south to southeasterly winds 5 to 15 knots, tending west to southwesterly 10 to 20 knots about the south. And the winds in the central north are more east to southeasterly at 5 to 15 knots. Into tomorrow, we'll see with that ridge still quite close, west to southwesterly winds of 5 to 15 knots about the south, and the winds tending east to southeasterly 5 to 15 knots about the north, and inshore afternoon sea breezes about the east. The swells around the west and the south through today and tomorrow are southwesterly of 1.5 to 2.5 metres, through the north a westerly of around 1 metre, and about the east a southerly of 1 to 2 metres. The wave rider buoy at Cape Sorel is currently showing a significant wave of 2.2 metres, a maximum wave of 3.5 metres, and a 17-second period.
And I believe the other wave rider buoy was a star at Agfest.
Yes, the remains of the wave rider buoy from Mariah Island, which is being fixed currently.
Yep.
And should be back and deployed once we've got it back in the state.
Terrific. Thank you for that, Matthew.
No worries. Have a great day.
You too. Matthew Thomas from the Bureau with all the information for you on the weather. So there you go. Might get some decent falls of rain, 10 to 30 mil in parts of the east coast over a three-day period later in the week. So nothing for King Island, unfortunately, according to that forecast. Our reporter Meg Powell heading to King Island tomorrow, so we'll have more of that possibly and explanation of what's going on there a little bit later in the week for you. Coming up, we'll take you back to Agfest and a story about Seed Lab.
Nightlife with Phil Clark.
We're about to play the Mighty Challenge.
We're up to question 12, but more importantly, 10 in a row for the Black Magnets. Which future US president married school librarian Laura Welsh in 1977?
George W. Bush.
10 in a row.
Now I'm going to die happy. Nightlife,
Monday to Thursday with Philip Clark on ABC Radio Hobart.
The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
According to one of our texters, around 80 mil at Marawa for April. It's green. The weather has been very good. Yeah, the weather's been good, but we really do need some rain, don't we? Especially in those areas that are suffering the most. Well, another successful AgFest concluded over the weekend, another chance for producers involved in Seedlab Tasmania to show off their wares to the public. In a moment, we'll hear from Lyle Davis from Bassview Timbers at Lulworth near Georgetown, whose business has been part of Seedlab. First, though, here's Fiona Breen talking to Hazel McTavish-West about Seedlab Tasmania and its role at AgFest.
Yeah, so Seedlab Tasmania is in its fourth year, and we're just working with another cohort of our accelerator program. We've got a number of our businesses here at AgFest, and we're just having a fantastic time watching the growth and the evolution that happens in our people.
You must be like a parent when you come to somewhere like AgFest and see some of the people that you've helped, you know, selling their goods. And
yeah, I do actually feel we all feel very familial to them and very warm, and the whole team, the Seedlab team, have been walking around supporting them with anything from hand warmers to snacks, to helping them with some site layout and also reminding them of selling skills, closing the deal, because that's why they're here. It's got to be profitable for everybody.
Well, you're kind of mentoring them through business, helping them build their little businesses, their ideas, getting them through the next step. Have you had some real success with some of these people?
Yes, and I think the thing that I've always learned with Seedlab is things take time. So seeing the evolution over time, for example, is it best to give you examples? Because I like to do that. Debbie from Pure and Purple up here, up in Main Street, she's got some evolution in her packaging, which looks absolutely fantastic. We've got Kirby over in the craft tent with her leather work, and she's done a major change in how she lays out her stall and talks about her products, even down to how she names her products. And Lyle here from Bassview, who's just come so far, and it's such a great AgFest story because Lyle and Wendy heard about Seedlab on the radio last year, came and chatted with us, put an application in, and have gone through the whole program, and now here they are at AgFest selling up a storm and winning awards.
Well, that's a good segue for me to go across to Lyle. Now, I hear congratulations are in order. Tell me about that.
This is our first year here, and we packing up yesterday afternoon and heading home, and we got a phone call from the AgFest committee saying that we were nominated for one of their site awards. And this morning, about probably 20 minutes ago, they come up and said, "Here, congratulations, you've won the small site award for 2024, which was, blew us out of the water. Like, yeah, it was just amazing.
Well, you've been involved with this Seedlab just for a short time now, but it's sort of taking you to the next level, helping you get a business organising, present yourself?
Oh, definitely. Like, the wife and I started this business a bit over two years ago, and we thought we were doing all right. And then, yeah, as Hazel said just a minute ago, that last year we were coming out for a visit, and we heard it on the radio, and I thought, I wonder if that's something that could help us get a little bit further than where we were. And so we came in and found them and spoke to Hazel, and we put in the application to go through the first stage of it last year. And since then, it's just, we've just grown immensely. Like,
what sorts of things has she helped you with, or the program helped you with?
Oh, the stuff that we have learnt that we had no idea on.
Things like marketing or presenting
marketing,
yourself?
Pricing. Like, we never had a clue on how to price something. We were just taking a stab in the dark at numbers and that. And then once we'd gone through the first stage of Seedlab, and were explained how to price things, we went through and done that, and we were going backwards. We were losing money, where now we're actually making money, and it's been great.
What got you into this business in the first place?
I've always liked working with timber, even when I was a kid, and uncles and grandfathers had sawmills where I'm from up in central Queensland. And when we moved down here, the timber I've seen that Tassie has down here is just beautiful. And I wanted to get back into it and get out of stressful jobs. And I started doing this, and also the fact that we've relied too much on being a throwaway society these days. We need to get back to what our grandparents and great-grandparents used to do. You build it once, you handed it down for generations. Instead of 3 or 4 years down the track, you throw it in the bin and go and buy another one. You know, like the stuff I've got here today, it'll pass on for 3 or 4 generations.
And do you have any trouble getting hold of the timber?
No, I've got a young bloke up at Lilydale that's got a sawmill up there. I source all my timber from him. He has something to do with the logging industry or something, I'm not quite sure. But he gets it and I buy it through him and turn it into the beautiful furniture that you're sitting at here today.
Fantastic. Well, congratulations on that win. And back to Hazel McTavish. Hazel, what are your plans with Seedlab now?
Well, Seedlab Tasmania is coming to an end shortly, which we're kind of sad about, but it's a funding-related thing. And the good news, however, and today, for the first time at AgFest, we're in the Woolworths marquee under the Seedlab Australia banner. And Woolworths have just confirmed another 3 years of funding for that program, which makes a difference to Tasmanian producers as well. We've got a number of businesses here at AgFest that have also gone through that program, like Thai Larder, Zia Relief, who are now in stores in Woolworths all around the country. And that program enables us to really focus a bit more on the fast-moving consumer goods, which are the things you buy every day in stores like Woolies, and help them with the same things we've been working with Lyle on everything from pricing to marketing to understanding what's unique about what they do, but adds in that layering of how to actually pitch it to a retailer and then promote it when it's in store to everyday people. So that's going to keep us busy for the next 3 years. And I think after that I might start doing some of my hobbies like Lyle's been talking about. I love timber as well, which I think's why we've really bonded with these guys. My dad was a cabinet maker and I grew up in a shed turning wood, hew and pine on the lathe and the smell, and I'm going to do a bit of that again.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for joining the Country Hour.
Thanks, Fiona.
Seedlab Tasmania CEO Hazel McTavish-West talking there to Fiona Breen at AgFest. And we also heard from Lyle Davis from Bassview Timbers at Lulworth, who was part of the Seedlab cohort.
How well do you know Hobart Towns?
Now we're barking home.
Tune into Breakfast with Rick Goddard all through May and play Canine Connections. You could win an ABC prize pack. Meet roving reporter Andy Goal at a dog park near you with your furriest family member. Can Rick identify your dog's breed by its name? For locations on where Andy will pop up next, keep listening to Breakfast with Rick Goddard on ABC Radio Hobart all through May to play Canine Connections.
The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Well, farmers now have access to updated information on the toxicity levels of insecticides to beneficial insects. The Beneficials Chemical Toxicity Table, updated by CSA Australia, rates the impact of insecticides on beneficial insects from low impact to very high impact. The beneficial insects can play a significant role in controlling pests in cropping systems, but are often the unintended victims of insecticide sprays. Angus Furley spoke to Dr. Rosie Knapp, research scientist at CSA Australia, about the guide.
The Beneficials Toxicity Table it's really just a summary of the toxicity of different insecticides against beneficial insects, important to the grains industry in particular. The table's been around for a little while now. We first launched it in 2022, but we've been updating it annually each year with new data coming out of our labs from our own bioassay testing of insecticides. In the latest update of the table, which was made live last week, we've actually filled all data gaps now in the table, so we're excited to include new data on hoverflies and spiders in particular into the table, which are both really important beneficials for agriculture.
So the table is essentially a quick reference where farmers, when they're planning to use whatever insecticides they may be, they can go to the table and quickly figure out how little or how harmful that particular insecticide can be to various insects?
Yeah, exactly. So what we've really done is tried to summarise all of the information out there and our own research into a really accessible resource, which you can just get the information from at a glance. So there's a lot of data backing it, but we've brought this all together to give each insecticide a rating of toxicity going from low to medium to high to very high in terms of how it will impact different important beneficial insects. So yeah, it's just really there to kind of help users navigate the different information in this space.
And can you just explain a bit about what you mean by beneficial insects and why farmers don't want to be killing those particular insects?
Yeah, absolutely. So beneficial insects, when we talk about beneficials, we kind of mean any insect which is not a pest to the crop. So these can be things like pollinators, or they can be natural predators of crop pests. So having these different species around is actually really useful for farmers, because they do a really good job of kind of naturally keeping pest populations at bay. They're already naturally occurring in like quite a lot of agricultural situations. And what we kind of really want to avoid is accidentally wiping these kind of good guys out when we're trying to spray insecticides to control for the pests. So it kind of helps unpick that a little bit and help farmers to identify pesticides which are going to be good against the pests, but they're going to keep a nice healthy population of beneficials as well.
So as a minimum, farmers don't want to be killing insects if they don't have to, but then beyond that, they could actually be creating themselves problems if they're killing insects that are out there doing a good job and controlling pests for them.
Yeah, exactly. You can kind of end up shooting yourself in the foot a bit if you spray something too hard. You wipe away all the pests and all of the things that are controlling the pests. So if the spray isn't completely effective and the pests bounce back, you've then wiped out one of your lines of defense against those pests. So in some situations, especially if you've got pests which are resistant to insecticides, you can actually sometimes end up doing more harm than good.
And just how effective can some of these beneficial insects be at controlling some of the pests?
They really vary. They can be very, very kind of targeted control agents of the pests. So things like aphid parasitoids in particular, these are wasps which they've evolved to specifically target aphids. So they have a really strong kind of host-specific relationship. If you've got aphid parasitoids around, the aphids do not really stand a chance. We are kind of ongoing research into actually quantifying the impacts in the field. But all in all, it's just good to keep populations of these beneficials healthy.
And can it be a tricky balancing act for farmers when, of course, they're wanting to use the most effective insecticide for the job, but then also weighing up what potential harm it might have to those beneficials?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a difficult thing to balance. So we've kind of tried to just present the information in as straightforward a way as possible to at least help some element of that decision-making process.
That was Dr. Rosie Knapp, research scientist at CSER Australia, speaking with Angus Verley about their guide to protecting beneficial insects. And that is our Country Hour for today. We will catch you after midday tomorrow.